And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Oscar Wilde's most popular play might be The Importance of Being Earnest. It's a play that many of us have seen, and it's now the playmaker's current and final main stage production for this season. And maybe you, like I have been wondering why this play is so popular after more than 100 years. And it's kind of, it stretches things a little bit, and its humor is kind of dated, but not so much. Anyway, how do you explain the ongoing popularity of this play? And I'm going to find out from the playmakers, from the director of this production, Matthew Arbour.
There you go, Arbour.
Matthew Arbour.
Rhymes with harbor.
Harbour. Just it like the way it should be. Actors, Jeremy Webb and Julia Coffey, who are my guests on Who's Talking. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you.
Well, Matthew Arbour.
There you go.
You heard my questions about
sure.
this play. What? Why? I mean, you know, it's just kind of gimmicky, isn't it? But it works. Why? What's the secret of it?
I mean, I guess it's gimmicky in that it's really a story about two different couples, and ultimately then three different couples who managed to, you know, by the time the play is over, to find their way around the question of how on earth are we going to get married? And so in that regard, it's like a lot of great classical comedies. You sort of set the lovers up, you throw a lot of things in their way. In this case, one of the most, you know, sort of glorious obstacles in the world in the character of Lady Bracknell. And they've found one another, but there's a lot of things to get done to get themselves to a happy ending. And it's the getting there that makes you want to sort of sit in the room and go along for the ride, because it, of course, goes absolutely as wrong as it can before it can ever go right. I would say, though, that for my money, the thing that makes us want to do the play over and over again, even now 100 years later, is that the play is completely joyful. That there's a lot of comedy that I find is either negative or disparaging or is about contempt, and there's not a hint of any of those things in this comedy. This is a comedy full of wit, full of language, and full of love, and all of those things are spun with a really sort of gloriously fun kind of approach, so that even though it might feel a little bit dated in that it's really about a Victorian society, ultimately what happens in it is something that has happened to all of us.
You know, a lot of people who'll be listening with us have seen the play,
yeah.
but have forgotten. Talk to those of us who've seen the play once or twice, but need to be reminded of how you will set it up when the play begins here in Chapel Hill.
Well, I guess, sir, you could sort of describe the story of the play for hours, because it's pretty complicated ultimately.
But almost too complicated, and you got to come see it to get everything. Yeah.
But I guess sort of the basic setup is Jack's in love with Gwendolyn, who is his friend Algernon's cousin, and Jack comes up to London to woo her. But in order to sort of get away from his country house where his ward and her governess live, he pretends to have a brother named Ernest. Who gets into trouble that he has to go rescue, and that kind of gets him out of the house and gets him to London to meet his girl.
Now we've got Jack and Gwendolyn here in the studio.
We do, and
we might hear from them later on. But the way in which, through complicated ways, they kind of finally mm-hmm. work it out is that's the string of the play, I guess.
That's the string of the play. The string of the play. So Jack is pretending to be Ernest in town, and is stuck being Jack in the country. And Gwendolyn is in love with Ernest in town and isn't aware of Jack in the country. And when she finds out, things change. You know, keeping her from finding out, and then what to do when she finds out is sort of all of how it comes
apart. Were these names, Ernest, was that – is the Ernest name – The Importance of Being Earnest is a title that misleads in a nice way.
Well, yeah, I think it's a really important play on words. You know, we don't use the word earnest, meaning sort of serious or help me out, guys.
Sincere,
sure. Very much anymore. But it's I think the subtitle of the play is a serious comedy for trivial people, and I think that's paradoxical, but exactly what's so fun about the play is that Oscar Wilde sort of turns everything that we think should be serious on its head, and as a result, you kind of come to the conclusion that a good life could be had if we did that a little more often. Mm. And so I think it is important to be earnest, but which is to say sincere, but I think it's important to be earnest about absurd things.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you just one more question, and then I want to hear from the principals.
Great.
You're a professional, highly regarded director, and when Joe Hodge called you and said, "Would you do this play?" What was your reaction? Did you say, "No, give me a Shakespeare, give me a modern playwright," or did you say, "Oh boy, Oscar Wilde, I've been waiting all my life to do this"?
I did actually say, "Oh boy, Oscar Wilde, I've been waiting to do this." I do Shakespeare and I do Moliere and I do a lot of classical work, but. Oscar Wilde is special, and I think it comes right back around to that. There's a line in the play, actually, it's Jack's line, that I keep holding on to, and he says some version of, "Oh, good heavens, don't try to be cynical. It's so easy to be cynical." And the thing about this play that I think is so special is that it acknowledges that by not being cynical at all. There's not a hint of cynicism or bitterness in this play. There's a lot of sharp pokes at about social propriety and about the way people ought to behave as compared to the way they like to behave. And all the while, you know, he's making fun of people without the slightest sharpness. It's the most generous and kind of joyful amusement that I think you could get at. There's no cynicism at all. And for me, it's just so cool to have spent 4 weeks every day in the presence of that. You know, that's the experience that I was after.
Well, Julia Coffey, you have the role of Gwendolyn. And,
yes.
And like Matthew Arbour, this is your debut here
yes.
in Chapel Hill with
mm-hmm.
the Playmakers. And when they called you to say, "We want you to do..."
I have auditioned for this play my entire professional career.
I have,
as either Cecily or Gwendolyn, or both sometimes. And this is the first time I've gotten cast in it. So I'm very, very happy to finally get a chance to play
the
part.
Well, then tell me this. What's the pull?
Well, the
for
writing.
The Gwendolyn role?
The writing is gorgeous and glorious and so fun to play. And when you have good writing, you don't have to work too hard. And it's just so much fun to ride the train.
Tell us more about Gwendolyn. Well, I mean, what is it about Gwendolyn that attracted you?
Well,
why do you want to be Gwendolyn?
She's deliciously, what is the word? Severe.
She's particular.
She's very particular. She's what we would call now high maintenance.
but she's very, I mean, like, well, come see Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn's nice looking, but she's tough. High maintenance is a good word, but she's
troublesome
is not the word. I mean,
she's high maintenance, but she's a rebel.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
wants out from under her mother's thumb, come blank or high water. You know, she really wants to get out of the house, and she has found somebody who is going to make her mother crazy. By marrying him, she could finally have her freedom, but she wants it done a particular way.
Well, now, who is this person she wants to marry?
Oh, my darling. My darling Ernest.
Now, is it Ernest or Jake?
Well,
Jack.
Jack, I mean, Jack. I'm sorry, I've got a grandson named Jake. But Jeremy Webb is also debuting. You all are all being initiated
mm-hmm. That's right.
by the Playmakers
That's
together,
right.
and
That's
you seem
right.
just very
happy to
be there. When you were approached, and did you try out, or did you?
Yeah, I did.
Did you try
I auditioned
out
in New York.
We auditioned
Julie
together,
auditioned.
Actually.
Did you really?
And
I
left the audition going, "Oh, I hope he gets it.
I hope he gets it.
He's so funny.
Going, I won't do it unless she gets
Aww.
It.
Oh, come on. Oh, no.
No, really.
We got a romance building here. Oh, wow.
No, she's just such a so right for it and such a terrific actress.
And Jeremy is hysterical in this part. It's so perfect for
Now, did you audition for this role before? Is this something you were already used to say, gosh, I need to work?
No, I have never auditioned for it before. But that's just the way careers go.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not because I haven't been interested in doing it before. I was offered the role of Algernon in a production 10 years ago, and I wasn't able to do it. Well, I was able to do it, but at the time I thought I wouldn't be able to do it. Anyway, stupid story, but I didn't do it. So this is my first time doing the play. And I feel exactly the way Julia feels about it. I mean, ultimately, it's the draw of the material. It's just, it's a tricky play. It's a classic play. It's a funny play. And, you know, funny is harder to get right than not funny.
I mean, and I don't, we haven't talked about this a whole
this
lot,
is Matthew,
but
I'm
sort of curious if I don't put you guys on the spot a little bit, because I was delighted to accept it and thrilled to be asked to do it, and simultaneously a little bit frightened.
Yeah.
That I'm in awe of the play.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of its popularity, and I'm aware of its history, and I'm aware of how well people know it.
Yeah.
And I was at the beginning, especially, a little bit intimidated by how great I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in working on it, I've been surprised by a lot of things. Have you guys been surprised by anything against your own sort of expectations of what it was? You know, now we're 3.5 weeks in.
Well, yeah, I've been surprised, and I don't want to jinx it because we're still at the early stages, and I don't want to jinx, you know, the journey for myself or, you know, how things are going as an actor. But I will say that I'm surprised at the depth of emotion behind the characters and behind the journeys. You know, ultimately, it's a high stakes play. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's still a play about real people pursuing, you know, actual needs. And I've been delightfully surprised at how easy it is to sort of access that level of the play.
This is Jeremy Webb answering, an actor in the Playmakers production, of the importance of being earnest, answering sort of an inquiry from his director, Matthew Arbor. And a great question. I tell you what, let's take a break and continue that discussion afterwards. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with the director of the Playmakers' current production, The Importance of Being Earnest, Matthew Arbor, and he's taken over the program and is talking to and he's talking
Gosh,
to
he is a director after all.
Jesus Christ.
He's talking to two of the stars of this production, Julia Coffey and Jeremy Webb, and I loved it because Matthew, you're asking them as you approach this play, which is one which many of us have seen before. It's part of the it's a play that folks love and can understand, but you have to figure out how you're going to do it in a way that people will appreciate it. And so,
sure. So I guess I sort of threw them the curveball question of you know, given that we all know the play so well and have expectations coming into it. As we've learned about it, have there been any sort of surprises, pleasant or unpleasant, in tackling making the play? Because I know that for myself, at least, I've found that I've seen the play so often, and whenever the play's around, I go see it. I love it that much, and I like to sit in the room with it and just take it in. It makes me feel good. But I have seen it often in ways that I thought, well, this isn't actually as satisfying as my gut tells me it could be. And usually it's either because it's a little too sitcom-y or it's actually it's so intellectual that I sort of think, well, for people who are falling in love, they seem awfully thoughtful and not particularly passionate. Like, that doesn't feel like what it's like when I've fallen in love. And so coming into it, I was really curious about how we were going to find out what was underneath that, how the falling in love part of it or the not being able to pursue falling in love was going to be a real thing that we could feel. And I've been delighted to find that it's not only something that we've found in the play, but it's something that sort of is underneath the play everywhere. Mm. So that was a surprise for me that it was the vitality of the play is like the air these people breathe. And so that sensation of all being okay with the world that comes from watching the play and being in the room with the play is actually already built into it automatically. It's just sort of there for us to tap into and let, and sort of release into the theater.
Well, Julia, you had your ideas about what the play would be like and what your role would be, and it interests me now that Matthew's described how attached he is to the play and what ideas he had about it. Whether as you began rehearsals and talking about the play, whether you all, I mean, at some point you had to come to see it the same way, I guess, but how did that come about?
I think once, you know, I think we all kind of did experience that same discovery of finding the underlying emotion to this very witty repartee, that they are still human beings with a heart and with real problems of trying to negotiate a life for themselves. And I think, though, the surprise for me, though, wasn't the emotion so much as the sort of standard archetype that Wilde wrote for Gwendolyn, and that I could not escape that, that is written in, and I have to give that its due. And I, as much research and as much imagining as I can do for myself to try and make it mine and unique, it's still Gwendolyn in Importance of Being Earnest, and I have to give that its due. And that's the brilliance of good writing, you know. A character is a character through and through, and it is solidly written that way. And I just have to just let Wilde take over and let Gwendolyn be Gwendolyn.
right.
Yeah.
Well, Jeremy, I mean, you have confessed that you had – this is sort of your first encounter with Wilde as a professional actor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did the – and you approached it with your director and then your co-star having firm ideas about Wilde. Did you just follow their lead, or did you come – bring in your own sort of ideas about
Well, Jack always follows Gwendolyn's lead. That's rule number one.
He's well trained.
I mean, as Matthew keeps saying, one of the things that we go by in this play is girls are scary, and I mean, I tend to feel less tied down to ideas about what Oscar Wilde may or may not be, because I feel like as an actor and as a creative artist, they keep me from experiencing what I might be able to bring to it. So I'm always more maybe listening more closely for the rhythms of the character as he occurs to me. I'm not so interested in playing Jack the way that anyone else has ever played him. I'm interested in playing Jack the way that I think the playwright is communicating to me that the character should be played. You know what I mean? So I definitely have my ideas about who Oscar Wilde was and the way that in quote-unquote Oscar Wilde play might be performed, but I keep feeling, as you know, Matthew said, we're in our fourth, heading into our fifth week of work on the play, like I'm kind of letting the language and the character take care of itself, and I'm just trying to be honest and true underneath it and sort of let the witticisms or the epigrammatic language or the things that we feel like we know to be true about Oscar Wilde to take care of themselves, or let Matthew shape them, but try to myself stay on track with, you know, what the character's experiencing honestly in every moment, and trying to make that true.
This is Jeremy Webb, who's playing Jack in The Importance of Being Earnest, and Matthew Arbour is the director. And you've heard these your two stars talk about their roles and how here's what I mean, this is a mean question. So, I mean,
you're going to ask me a mean question on here.
Prepared.
both of them have said they're guided by the words, by Oscar Wilde's words in the play. And yet you must have your idea, and directors would have different ideas about how to transform those words into a theater experience for today that is vibrant and meaningful. And are you just being guided by Wilde's words, or have you got some of your own self to put into this play?
Well, I think it's some sort of bizarre marriage of the two. I mean, Wilde's words are... Oscar Wilde gets as much content into one exchange of dialogue as many playwrights will get into whole scenes. The language he uses is famously so rich, has so much both sound and music, but also meaning and sort of filigree. And he's created a world where people both talk and listen at a higher metabolism than any of us do in our daily lives. And one of the great, I mean, I have to say, just sort of watching these actors work, it's a nearly athletic thing to perform.
Why? This is words you said. Not this isn't gymnastics. This
is mental gymnastics.
It's mental gymnastics.
And for Jack, physical. I mean, it's a very physical role for you.
Yeah, you have to think fast with a play like this.
Very fast.
You know, you have to think fast. You have to warm up. You have to arrive at the stage awake and ready to think fast for 2 hours. And that gets back to the appeal of the piece. I mean, that's why it's and I would also say, I would add the idea that it should seem absolutely effortless.
And like, I think Matthew's added to that in his direction. He's allowed it to sort of breathe and not be stifled by Victorian constraints.
That's right.
Constraints.
It has a natural rhythm, you know, natural rhythms.
Well, one of the choices that you had, Matthew, is you have the words, but you don't have the accents directed.
No, we're working with a highly skilled, a really superb speech and dialect coach, a woman named Bonnie Raphael, who's part of the Playmakers Repertory Company. And she and I met a few times before rehearsals even began to sort of clarify how we were going to shape the dialect and what we were interested in. And we're using really upper class British dialect for the performance of the play. And as it happens, you know, that's the right instrumentation for this kind of music.
Why?
Because it's the sounds that he heard in his own ear as he wrote them.
So it's like opera in the sense that if you tried to change it into an American modern dialect, you would lose some of his poetry.
I think you'd lose the poetry and I think you'd think it sounded weird. Mm-hmm. I think you'd really feel like it was foreigners in a world they didn't belong in. Mm-hmm. There is a Britishness to the play that has to do with the way the British think and behave and have for centuries that allows it to just sort of sing its own song when you keep it in a British context.
Here's what worries me about that challenge is that that's so hard. I mean, it is hard. It's like sword fighting or something like that to talk the way others talked 100 years ago.
Indeed.
That you have to spend so much time worrying about that and working on it and maybe making a miscue or something
I think it's lovely that you think it's something, it's a skill like sword fighting because it actually is a skill. It's something that actors acquire as part of their tools, and it's kind of their professional responsibility to be proficient in those tools so that they their homework, in fact, is to learn to inhabit that way of speaking outside of all of the rest of the work so that they are fluent.
Well, let's do this. If we take a break and you can work with your actors, can you give us an example of what we might see and hear
in the
play and see how they're doing with their dialects or their accents?
Brilliant.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm D.G. Martin. My guests are from the Playmakers. They're really all sort of new guests of the Playmakers, making their debut in connection with the Playmakers' final production of on the main stage of this season, Oscar Wilde's play, The Importance of Being Earnest. And Matthew Arbour is the director, and he's brought with him actor Jeremy Webb, who's playing Jack, and Julia Coffey, who's playing Gwendolyn. We talked about both the excitement and the difficulty of bringing 100-year-old Victorian British accents into the play, and also some of the wonderful things that Oscar Wilde does with words. And Matthew, you've agreed to share a little bit of that with us and maybe give us a little inside preview of the play.
Well, we've got there's a scene in the middle of Act One where Jack and Gwendolyn have found themselves in the parlor of Gwendolyn's cousin Algernon, in the company of Gwendolyn's mother, Lady Bracknell. And Algie has contrived to get Lady Bracknell out of the room so that Jack and Gwendolyn can have a moment alone together. And so this is the scene after once they find themselves there without any supervision.
So they're by themselves. I mean, this is the magic moment here.
He's got his girl unchaperoned.
All right. Well, I wish you all could see this. Let's listen.
Charming day it has been, Miss Fairfax.
Pray don't talk to me about the weather, Mr. Worthing. Whenever people talk to me about the weather, I always feel quite certain that they mean something else, and that makes me so nervous.
I do mean something else.
I thought so.
And I would like to be allowed to take advantage of Lady Bracknell's temporary absence.
I would certainly advise you to do so. Mama has a way of coming back suddenly into a room that I've often had to speak to her about.
Miss Fairfax, ever since I met you, I have admired you more than any girl I have ever met since I met you.
Yes, I'm quite aware of the fact. And I often wish that in public, at any rate, you had been more demonstrative. For me, you have always had an irresistible fascination. Even before I met you, I was far from indifferent to you. We live, as I hope you know, Mr. Worthing, in an age of ideals. The fact is constantly mentioned in the more expensive monthly magazines and has reached the provincial pulpits, I am told. And my ideal has always been to love someone of the name of Ernest. There is something in that name that inspires absolute confidence. The moment Algernon first mentioned to me that he had a friend called Ernest, I knew I was destined to love you.
You really love me, Gwendolyn?
Passionately.
Darling, you don't know how happy you've made me.
My own Ernest.
But you don't really mean to say that you couldn't love me if my name wasn't Ernest.
But your name is Ernest.
Yes, I know it is. But supposing it was something else, do you mean to say that you couldn't love me then?
Ah, that is clearly a metaphysical speculation, and like most metaphysical speculations, has very little reference at all to the actual facts of real life as we know them.
Personally, darling, to speak quite candidly, I don't much care about the name of Ernest. I don't think the name suits me at all.
It suits you perfectly. It is a divine name. It has a music of its own. It produces vibrations.
Really, Gwendolyn, I must say, I think there are lots of other much nicer names. I think Jack, for instance, a charming name.
Jack? No. There is very little music in the name Jack, if any at all, indeed. It does not thrill. It produces absolutely no vibrations. I have known several Jacks, and they all, without exception, were more than usually plain. Besides, Jack is a notorious domesticity for John, and I pity any woman married to a man called John. She would probably never be allowed to know the entrancing pleasure of a single moment's solitude. The only really safe name is Ernest.
Gwendolyn, I must get christened at once. I mean, we must get married at once.
Married?
There's no time to be lost.
I mean, the secret of all of this, in case you didn't catch it, is that it's Jack talking, pretending
to be
Ernest.
To be Ernest, yes. And now trying to get engaged as Jack or Ernest in any way he can, really.
And so we got to come to the play to see how he works his way out of the situation, because this girl is really in love with Ernest.
She's in love with Ernest.
And he's Jack, but she likes him as Ernest.
Yes.
And that, I mean, we got to the heart of the play, and I mean, that's what's fun about it. I mean, it's no secret because we know that, but Right. Seeing how we get there is the fun part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that brings up the question that a director of a well-loved play must feel every time, and that is, oh my golly, they know what this play is about. It's a story
so
many times before. How am I going to tell it better?
Yeah, well, I think there's something to be said for not necessarily needing to tell it better. I mean, maybe just to tell it really, really well, or as well as you'd want it told to yourself. And I think that's if I had to say one of my favorite things about being a director is I think it's a privilege. I think that directors are honored by being the one member of the audience that gets to talk back to the performance and say, you know what, I would actually prefer to be told that this way. And so that's how I think about myself. And that's really how I watch the play in rehearsal, is that I'm always sitting there in that gloriously privileged seat of being able to be told the play exactly the way I want it.
Oh, yeah. And I like that. But you have to have a supreme confidence in your judgment and everything to be able to say, yes.
Well, there's a little ego involved.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, for well, sure. I hope there you know, is, yeah. Or at least a sense. And I keep, there's, it's, it, as I've sort of developed in my career, I've learned more specifically that I keep a couple of, there's a couple of people in my head who are the audience point of view that I carry with me. And the mm-hmm. first, of course, is mine and my own sort of taste and my own exuberance for being told a story. I just love that experience. And so that's really what's at work all the time. And quite frankly, I often will take a particular run through or a particular sequence, and I'll simply see what I think it would be like if my mother were sitting next to me. Because I love the experience of sitting in the theater with her and I have such a full understanding of how she receives storytelling and what's important to her when she goes to the theater. And one thing that I've learned from her and from the experience of kind of pretending she's sitting next to me is that she's always really interested in, well, what people are like as opposed to what we think people are like. She has a really high-tuned gift for understanding human nature. Mm-hmm. And I like to believe I've inherited some of that. But certainly when I pretend she's there with me, my sort of skill for appreciating it goes up. And I think, again, to come back, that being a director, that is the full treat. I mean, you accept a lot of the glory, you accept all of the responsibility, but it is ultimately a privilege.
Wow. Your technique is like way more Freudian than I ever knew that.
Yes, we're learning new things about you.
You've heard.
It's funny when you talk in that other voice, the high pitched voice. You know, I never realized you were doing your mother.
But you knew it was getting better, right?
Absolutely. No, I like your mother. I like when your mother's directing. Don't get me wrong.
You're listening to Jeremy Webb, the actor, commenting on director Matthew Arbour's really nice description of what it's like to be a director of a play like this. We're going to take a quick break. But those of you who heard this wonderful scene from The Importance of Being Earnest surely must want to see it in action. It's the Playmakers' last main stage production for the year. It'll be on at the Paul Green Theater until March 21st. If you'd like more information, you can call 962-7529. That's 962-PLAY. We'll be right back and we'll see if we can learn a little bit more about our guest director and guest actors. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about The Importance of Being Earnest, which is the Playmakers' current production on through March 21st at the Paul Green Theater. If you're interested, as surely you must be if you've listened to these great actors and the great director, call 962-7529, 962-PLAY for information. Or you can look on our website, and we'll have a link to the Playmakers' website where you can find information about the play. During the break, these guys, all of whom are guests appearing with the Playmakers for the first time, Matthew Arbour is the director, and Jeremy Webb and Julia Coffey are the actors, the lead actors, and they expressed an excitement about working with one of our favorite actors, Ray Dooley. But I should have said the person playing Lady Brack. No, and then it's Ray. What in the world's going on here?
Yeah, Ray has stepped handsomely into maybe what is the most well known or famous role of the play, and he's taken on Lady Bracknell with us.
He cuts quite a fine figure.
He's gorgeous. He's positively gorgeous.
Now, Lady Bracknell, what is her relationship?
She's my mother.
Your
Gwendolyn's mother.
Mama.
She's Gwendolyn's mother. The high priestess of Wilde's world, I think, and she is through whom all requests for marriage have to go through.
Wow. Oh, wow.
She's, you know, in this play, there are several characters that are really trying to move forward into the future, and there are other characters who are really trying to pull the reins back and keep everybody back in the Victorian era, you know? And I think Lady Bracknell is an example of one of those characters. You know, she is way into propriety and rules and not allowing her daughter to do or to be a modern woman, much to her daughter's chagrin. But I think, well, you have to see the play, but mm-hmm. Gwendolyn sort of...
Well, I think you all have persuaded us. If you joined us late, listen to this again. We'll replay it, and it be available on the web for you to listen to. But the scene which our two actors have given us is great. But I will tell you what, I would pay the price of the ticket just to see Ray Dooley dressed up like a Victorian lady and to have him do whatever you, Matthew, whatever you're going to have him do.
Well, I think it's really confusing having him in the men's dressing room with us, I have to say. I mean, I came in the first day and I was like, wait a minute.
Right.
Lady Bracknell is in here with the guys?
Suit, gown.
suit.
Quite a gown.
Hips.
Right.
Hips. And there's a hip suit. You know, it's like...
Well, I want to move away from the play for just a moment, although there are plenty of things to talk about. And I'd love for you guys who are newcomers, new visitors to Chapel Hill, to talk about how you got here, how you got into the theater world. And Matthew Arbor, you're the director. Growing up, what was it about your growing up experience that led you into the theater?
Accident, I think, chiefly. I didn't really get involved in theater until I was a college student. And at that point...
Where were you in college?
I graduated from Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. That's where I was a college student. And I was pre-med. I come from a medical family. I was going into the family business. I had a deep love of science and medicine, and I thought for sure that's where I'd end up. But I had two roommates, one of whom was an actor and one of whom was a lighting designer when I first got there, that the college had sort of assigned us to all live together in the same dorm. And so they both immediately started doing theater. And to be perfectly honest, what I noticed was they met girls in a hurry. You know, that they just had a really instant social life that I thought, well, this is silly. I should go find out more about this. So, in fact, my degree is in molecular biology, but I became an actor. And not a very good actor. By the time college was over, I had been dissuaded from continuing to act. And that was really quite a great gift to me, because what I ended up doing just before I finished my undergraduate career was directing my first production. And I realized all of a sudden that I had struggled with acting because I couldn't focus myself on one part of the play.
Well, you like to do that. You like to be in charge of the whole thing.
Well, and it wasn't so much about being in charge necessarily. It was that I was interested in the whole thing. I couldn't keep my attention kept straying to like how this part goes with this part and how it leads to that part and what that would be like to look at. And what I love about actors is that they disappear in their imaginations into something very specific and really cohesive. And I just couldn't do it. I kept getting distracted. So what I learned about directing was that that was a better fit for me, and that I felt really good about giving, sort of creating something to then give away to a bunch of people at the same time, to sort of make something and show it to you.
Well, mm-hmm. What a great story.
Kind of turned me on.
Hmm. Well, Judy, how about you? Did you grow up wanting to be an actress?
I did. Yeah. I am one of those that was bitten by the bug quite early on. I went to sophisticated school in Washington, D.C., where I grew up.
Yeah, and where did
played,
you go to school?
National Cathedral School.
Oh, well.
All
okay.
girls school. Yeah. And in the fourth grade, I played Ophelia. And that was it. I knew. That, coupled with the fact that my parents were great fans of theater and took me quite often to the Shakespeare Theater, the Folger, that was it. I just fell in love, and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
So you grew up in Washington, and still, is that still your home base?
No, I live in New York, but I visit D.C. quite often, and it's a wonderful town to visit.
Great theater town.
How about you, Jeremy?
I, similarly to Julia's story, I was sort of came out of the womb acting. You know, I mean, I just
Where always, did you grow up?
Ithaca, New York, born and raised in
Ithaca. And around the university, or you just...
Yeah, around the university, two blocks from the university. We lived in College Town, and that whole awesome, awesome university was our playground as kids. I mean, we used to run and play cops and robbers at that school, and my first play was playing the boy in Beckett's Waiting for Godot at Theater Cornell when I was in second grade, and there were just all kinds of tremendous opportunities to act when I was a kid at the Hangar Theater, which was the summer theater, and... Theater Cornell and lots of community theaters. And I remember my mom and dad sitting me down in third grade and saying, because I was like a crazy freak for plays and for acting. And the deal was that if I kept my grades up, you know, during the year, I could do three but no more plays during the school year. And then in the summer, I could do as many plays as I could fit in.
That was the deal. That was the deal. And so you kept your grades up.
I kept my grades up so I could do the three plays. Yeah.
Well, I'm also these are great stories, but I'm also interested in particularly you, Jeremy, since you come from a college town. How are Chapel Hill and Ithaca alike, and how are they different?
They're amazingly alike. I mean, it's you know, there are three towns that all remind me of each other in this country: Ithaca, New York; Chapel Hill; and Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah,
for some reason,
yeah.
But they all have the same
great public universities.
You know, the resources that are available in a town like this are just so far beyond what might be available in towns where there's not, you know, a major learning institution. I mean, you know, I just love the posters that you see on the corner.
Yeah, I know you see. Right.
For $5, you can go hear a, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning author speak at a bookstore, or for free, you know, or you can go to the university and see, you know, a symphony orchestra play usually for free or for, you know, under $10. And yeah, those are incredible opportunities that aren't available.
Well, I hope the folks who are listening to you in Chapel Hill will realize what a great thing we've got here. Yeah, that's right.
I hope so too.
Matthew, how about you? How does Chapel Hill strike you?
I'm actually having a terrific time here. I mean, I have to say, I spend a great deal of it indoors.
You're working too hard. I tell you what, we're out of time. So, Gwendolyn, I mean, are we like Washington?
No, but I love it here. My mother is from the South, so I have a great fondness for this area.
Well, I hate to end this conversation because you guys have gotten me all excited, about the play, of course, but then in watching you all perform your roles. And Matthew, thanks for sharing your actors with us and for coming to Chapel Hill and giving us another look at this great play.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. If you'd like to go to The Importance of Being Earnest, and you should very much not pass this one by, it's the last production, call 962-PLAY. More information and ordering tickets from the Playmakers. See you soon.